Last time I misspoke slightly. I referred to a class of Panthera cats, and in that class, two different species, which are both carnivores, and so we can class them as carnivores. But I use the word class loosely. So actually, in the taxonomic order, the class is mammals and the order is carnivore. And so if we recognize among dogs and cats of the genus canine and feline similarities, one of them will be that they are meat eaters and that they have evolved accordingly. So this is the short form of the normal taxonomic order of living things. Now I'm going to give you a collection of species to look at. And I would like you to just flip through, and I don't have enough for everyone, so maybe if you should share and you should share, then you'll have enough. And please don't take these home with you. I use them in my high school biology class. If you'll just flip through them and generally notice as you flip through them those who are carnivores and those who are herbivores, and among the carnivores notice the ones that you would group together in the same genus. And then one of the two or each of you should make a note on the first page as you go through together and identify families of carnivores and genuses of carnivores and species of carnivores. Try to make a note on the front page of which carnivores you would put in the same species and which you would put in the same genus. In other words, make groups of species and larger groups of genuses of just the carnivores.
Just the carnivores?
Yes.
Everybody else, cows and horses don't get included.
Now, don't give away the secrets here. I want to see how well you identify carnivores, then families of carnivores, and then genuses of carnivores, and finally species of carnivores.
Learn more than it just passive knowledge.
thing is.
And when you switch this is out, it'll be more and more unstoppable, like, you know, that's kind of. I don't think, you know, they eat themselves when it is necessary.
Just to make things easy for you, what you basically want to do is isolate the members of the family Canidae and the members of the family Felidae. And then group them according to genus and species.
Could you tell us a little about Canidae? I'm not familiar, but would a bear be Canidae?
No. But a bear is a carnivore.
Yes, yeah.
But it's not a canidae.
What are canidae besides the canine?
I want you to use your eyes and by a process of elimination determine those which you think would fall into that category. And as I said, mainly I want you to concentrate on genus and species. Come on, Vladimir, you have to do it too.
So the family of the bear would be our sign.
Write your notes on the front page. Yeah, I want you to make a list of the species which fall into each category of genuses.
These two only.
Yeah, those two only. Just lost the light, too bad. You can write on it, it's okay.
You just put it down for a second?
No, it's okay.
Yeah? Because I want to give some light. Maybe.
Oh.
Maybe. Maybe not.
Okay, it was set. Okay.
I will set you back. It's no problem.
Maybe it was on full screen.
It will be on full screen again.
But don't put it on right now because yes. They can't see that.
Yes. That's what I thought. So we will put this and then we
just
do the
next.
That's good enough.
Just to give you light.
Okay. How many we're going to reduce everything now to quantitative information. How many different families have you derived from your observation?
We started three.
Three families?
Families.
Anybody else have a number of families?
Five.
Anybody else have a number of families? Okay, how many genuses did you arrive at?
You only asked us to look for the carnivores.
Find all the carnivores and then group them according to genus and species.
All the carnivores.
So they're all animals, they're all mammals. They are not all carnivores.
Yes.
There are many of these who are not included in your group. There are some that are included in your group that may not be canines and felines.
Okay. I'm saying three again, Rob.
Pardon?
I'm saying three once more. For genus, I say three.
Did you say three for genus?
Genus, yeah.
Anybody else have a number for genus? How many species are there? Combined, total 11.
Total 11 species. In varying groups.
Yeah. In varying what kind of groups? Genuses? Okay. How many species did you get?
Five.
You got five species or genuses?
Okay,
How many classes did you get?
Sigbert,
you have a number, Sigbert?
I mean birds, you can add birds,
dogs, birds.
Species?
Mammiferous.
11.
Wow.
How many genuses, how many families, and how many species? There's only one order.
Unless the kangaroo is not considered.
Yeah, right. It's actually not. It's considered maybe it's a subclass, but it's a marsupial, so that's a little bit different from most mammals. Anybody else want to contribute to the number of species?
Nine.
Anybody else?
Ten.
You can't guess, you have to. It has to be based on observation. It's according to what you see, yes. And what you think, and what you know.
I've got 13 species.
So that's 13 species of Canidae and Felidae.
Only
Canidae and Felidae. Oh, no.
You did not specify.
I did specify.
No. Right. You said carnivore.
I understood carnivores.
Yes. Yes. So I just want to give you a direction.
No, I said.
You said
pick the carnivores and then decide which ones belong to Canidae and Felidae and which are species in those two families.
Okay. So take my numbers to 229. Five species.
Yeah. What do you mean? Two each?
Two families, two genuses. Nine species.
Two families, two.
Canidae, Felidae.
Genuses and nine species.
Nine species.
I'll say, right, five species. Four species.
You'll take five?
Yes.
Three, five.
Okay. You say three or four?
This is really giving us experience.
Do you agree on the families and the genuses? Do you agree on those?
But I can't understand like a study, but Canidae and canine, and Felidae and feline.
Yeah, but there are other Canidae than the canines.
Oh.
There are Canidae who are not canines.
Yes.
Such as?
Let's say it again, but it was.
What is exactly Canidae?
Okay, now.
Maybe the pet.
I don't remember.
Tell me the name of the, Sandy? Tell me the name of the two genuses that you found.
Canine and feline.
Tell me the name of the two families that you found.
Canidae and Felidae.
Tell me the name of all the canines that you found.
A dingo, a lab, a collie, and a wolf.
Okay, can you tell me the biological names?
They're not all in here.
No, but which ones are in there?
Lupus dingo.
Lupus dingo. Is that a species or a genus?
That's a species.
Hmm?
Okay, it says for the dingo. Canis dingo, comma, C. familiaris dingo, or C. lupus dingo.
Which one is that one?
All for the dingo.
Okay, canis?
Canis dingo.
Dingo.
Yes.
Do you think that that's a genus or a species?
I think that is a species, myself.
Well, dingo is the species.
But dingo is a dog.
And canis is the genus.
The dingo is a canis, so I'll review that one.
Go ahead.
So, I'll tell you because I've had lessons on the wolf.
Please tell.
The wolf and the dog have no difference.
But I don't want to know that. I want to know what are the names of the species that you have isolated?
The tiger, lion, leopard, cat, big cat. The dog, it's wolf, dog, all of those are identical.
I have another scientific name for it.
They're
okay, tell me.
You know what you put in there?
Okay.
Which I would write right next to canis and dingo. And I would argue that canis and canine are the same. This is an ending there.
And what, do you have any others that belong to this species? I mean, this genus?
Well, I would say that the collie and the lab both fall into that, but they don't have their scientific names here.
You would say that they're Canis collie and Canis lupus? Canis lab?
Canis
collie and the retriever.
Collie and Canis Labrador retriever? Sure.
Sure,
yeah.
Okay, there's the Labrador and there's the collie.
Collie, yeah.
Is that all that's there?
As far as my estimation of canines.
So there would be Canis domesticus? Is there such a creature?
Yeah. Okay, now cats. How many cats are there?
Four. Honey.
What are they?
Tiger, lion, leopard, and domestic cat.
Okay, the tiger and the lion are Panthera leo and. What's the other one?
Panthera pardus.
The leopard.
Isn't the tiger the panthera tiger?
And what is the tiger?
Doesn't say.
Tiger it says. Bengal tiger.
It's not a Bengal tiger. It's a Siberian. Okay.
And then the Asian golden cat and the Abyssinian cat are the same kind. Same
so there's
species.
An Asian cat.
They're the same species.
And an Abyssinian cat?
Yes.
The Abyssinian cat is a domestic cat.
I wouldn't call them
a nice pussy cat.
Okay.
And they're called Felix.
Felix?
Felix. Is as.
What's the full name?
Well, the Asian golden cat is Felis Tamaniki.
Felis what?
Tamaniki.
Okay, and what's the other one? What's the other one?
It doesn't have one. It's Abyssinian, red, or sorrel.
Okay.
So Abyssinian.
Felis Abyssinian.
Sure.
Okay, so if we have Felis for these two, Panthera for these two, and Tigris for this one, that indicates that they occur in different genuses.
Different genuses?
Yeah, so that would be one, two, three.
So you mean the Panthera, the two Pantheras are different?
No, they're different species, but they're in the same genus. So that would be 1, 2, 3, 4.
That's 4. Only 4.
4 there.
Okay.
And then these two and these two are different.
Yeah. Sure.
I'm not sure what the Labrador and the Collie would be called, but isn't there one other dog there?
Not that I saw a cat.
No, there are. The wolves, the dingo, the collie, and the labrador.
Okay.
And the retriever. Yes, there's a retriever.
That's the lab.
That's the lab.
Okay. Everybody agree with that classification?
So
the total number of species that we are looking at is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 species.
Okay.
And we know that those 9 share either dog or cat characteristics. They're among quite a large group of such creatures, and they're carnivores, and they're mammals, and they're vertebrates, and they're animals. Okay. So we know from observation easily how to determine an animal with a spinal cord, a mammal, a carnivore, and various species of these creatures. Did you notice the koala?
Yes.
In your package?
Yeah, we didn't know if it ate meat or not.
No because way!
It's
no.
Only eucalyptus. Okay. So it did not go in the canine corner.
And you noticed the primates?
Yeah. Yes.
And you noticed the hooved species?
There were also two bears.
And you notice the two bears.
Yes.
What are the names of the bears?
The grizzly American.
Horribilis.
Horribilis.
Ursus horribilis.
Ursus.
Ursus.
Yes. Ursus.
So that is a family, right? Ursus is a family? So.
Ursus is a family, yeah.
So when I initially said 3, I was counting Ursus as a family.
I see.
That's because these are carnivores.
Right. No, if you're counting all of those different, is there any other carnivore than Ursus?
Not that we know.
No, they're omnivores.
Okay.
How
many of those species in the packet? Just from one more question.
Hoofs.
Hippopotamus.
The hippopotamus. Probably has toes, huh?
Padded
toes.
No, I don't.
What, Rob?
Which of those, from looking at all those pictures,
yes.
Which ones would you say would be most endangered?
The tiger.
The gorilla. What was the question?
Which ones would you say are most endangered?
Tiger.
Endangered?
Tiger.
Endangered.
Yeah,
tiger, leopard.
Okay.
Grizzly bear.
Tiger, leopard, grizzly. Grizzlies are pretty prolific these days. Grizzlies.
Gorillas.
Gorillas are very high.
Lions.
Do we need them in the world?
In the world.
Are they all endangered or not? Is it our packet of endangered species?
Too many gorillas in the world.
I just want to say that.
Sorry.
What we know from Europe is that mountain animals are in big trouble because of the climate change. Mm-hmm. So white fox is disappearing like anything.
There's no white fox in that packet though.
No, but it is.
No, I was just asking you to try to identify on the basis of appearance and what you know, which animals in that packet might be the most endangered.
All the big cats.
Sandy?
Except
I would say that the animals that have the most limited habitat are the most endangered because we are destroying habitat.
Yeah, which ones would those be?
Gorillas,
the big cats. The wolf,
yes.
The grizzly bear,
the koala.
Pretty much all of them.
What about the rhino?
The rhino.
Sorry,
I missed
the carnivore page here.
They're
shot.
No, in the packet, I said.
I know. I'm sorry. Trophies.
So are the lights off for good now, or can we turn them back on? Okay. When we ended last time, we ended with an idea of Jean Gebser. No, not Jean Gebser. Henri Bergson. An idea of Bergson that categorical knowledge, the kind of knowledge that determines quality, quantity, and form, that kind of knowledge is what we derive from. How do I get this screen back here?
Yeah, and then I take your document. Yeah, and do the same. View, full screen.
Needs to be larger.
Okay, make it also larger. Control.
Is that large enough?
Needs to be bigger.
Even bigger?
Yeah.
I'll do it. So if we think about these animals for a minute that we just looked at, and we think about this exercise that we just did, what does it enable us to know about dogs? If we consider the exercise that we just did, of categorizing Canis lupus and Collie under the class of carnivores and the genus of wolves and domestic dogs and so on. What does that tell us about dogs?
Diversity is a myth.
The difference between dogs and cats? Yeah. What do we now know about dogs?
They're coming from shoes.
But so are the hippopotamus and the rhinoceros and the bull. No, that wasn't the question. No, I didn't ask it, what do we know about the origin of dogs, but what do we, and we couldn't anyway know about shrews from this exercise that we did now.
We know what they look like.
We know that they share characteristics.
Okay.
Visible characteristics.
So if we study from the taxonomic point of view and from the point of view of phyletic descent and variation and adaptation, and we learn about all the processes of evolution that we can learn about in this way, then what do we really know about any of those creatures and how they are?
There can be many different variations of.
Yeah.
Not very much. How's that for
you?
Almost nothing.
Yeah, almost nothing. Right.
I saw a picture of a leopard in a tree, so I would say that leopards like trees.
You know about the picture, and you can infer certain things from the picture.
Based on the background, yes.
And from your experience and what you've read and so on, you know quite a lot about the species that have been involved in our lives and that we have seen and experienced. And so when you look at these pictures, you know what they are because you have some experience of these things. So you can identify them, you can put a name on them. And if you think back over the last weeks of our discussions here, you can do what Vladimir did. You can remember that they have common origins. And one of the questions that has been raised here is, based on the knowledge that we have of common origins and the processes of variation and adaptation, how is our understanding of the meaning of life, the meaning of existence, the way we live, the decisions that we make, how are these things influenced by this knowledge? Are there some truths that we can derive from our increased knowledge and interest in the descent of species that will be meaningful to us in our relationship with others and our understanding of the meaning of existence, our theory of knowledge? Will any of these philosophical questions be influenced by this kind of knowledge? In what ways will our understanding of reality, our theory of knowledge, and our decisions in life be enhanced in some way by an understanding of the descent of species?
Understanding of our nature,
the commonalities of our...
Okay, good. So we may have a greater sense of empathy for others. How else, Kirti?
Well, it also shows us that we are all connected. Everything we do impacts all the other creatures that live around us, and those impact the other creatures, and so on. So if we understand it really, really well, then we'll know everything that we do.
Okay, let me ask you then, push it a little bit further. Do you have some knowledge of the mutual impact that creatures have on each other?
Yes.
Can you give an example?
Well, the food chain is a good example. Whales need plankton for survival. Plankton is destroyed because human beings make holes in the ozone, and the whales are going to be
okay.
Domesticated animals shall inherit the earth.
Inherit the what?
Domesticated animals will inherit the earth with humans because they're useful to us. No others will perish. Domesticated to us.
Right. Have you read Oryx and Crick?
Yes.
A novel called Oryx and Crick. It's about that. Domesticated animals inherit the earth, and not only are they domesticated, but they're genetically altered. And so they're able to inherit the earth because they're smart enough to eat just about everything except the few species that are left. And
1984 also?
No. Okay, anyway. Does anybody else have some insight from last week's discussion? One of the things that we discussed was the idea of unity that underlies the biosphere, genetic unity, the unity of behavior, the unity of structure. Are we to some extent in touch with the idea or principle of unity as a result of exposure to these patterns of diversity that we've been exploring?
Emotion?
Say more?
Something that we have in common with animals?
Maybe, yeah. How do we know that?
Well, we feel it. Well, not with snakes, certainly not.
But if we consider this thing that we looked at about the fetus developing through all the stages of evolution, then it's very humbling to know that our origins are, in the shrew.
Origins.
What about the worm? Don't discount the worm.
We have to feel connected.
Today I was going and I saw this squirrel. I thought, this is a shrew. No, it is also this little time.
It's a robot.
And I thought this archetype, this body architecture, dominated all the time and made varieties and survived and gave so many different bodies.
The family name is rodent.
Huh?
Rodent.
Yes.
And not the shrew. Shrew is not a rodent.
So,
no, I mean to say that it comes from one origin. It resembles.
Okay, one of the things that happens in philosophy is that, and it has happened quite pervasively in 20th century philosophy, is that the field of epistemology, of looking at knowledge, thinking about knowledge, and how do we derive knowledge in the first place, and then how does it impact our behavior? The question of knowledge, the question of the relationship between our formal understanding of things and things themselves becomes quite significant as human knowledge develops. It's not as significant in classical philosophy. There's an assumption, as Vladimir was pointing out in the origin of the understanding of language, there's an assumption of connectedness in the earlier period of civilization and the earlier phases of philosophy in the classical period. But in the modern period, and especially in the 19th and 20th century, as knowledge explodes, there arises a very sharp interrogation of knowledge itself.
Well, I mean, it's good to differentiate between knowledge and information, because I can read all these books and it's given me information. But my deeper understanding, which I think is what knowledge is, will often maybe come from a relationship with reading the book, but also with my experience of nature as I see it myself. I mean, I would have thought that in this century the explosion has been one of information.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you know, knowledge has been swamped.
Well,
slightly.
Okay, this is a possibly useful distinction to make between information and knowledge. But that's the sort of thing that has to be interrogated. That's the kind of questioning that's necessary in order for the human being to feel that our life is meaningful. And before the information age, this question was still asked, because it's possible to perceive in our thinking processes that the data that we collect through observation gets organized by us in the way that we understand biology, you know, that organization of information is what is normally known as knowledge. So we know about the theory of evolution, and the theory of evolution is based upon extensive observation and a process of synthesizing rationally according to categories of quantity and quality and relationship, vast amounts of information, so that it becomes possible for a Darwin to organize vast amounts of information in terms of principles. And that is generally understood to be by knowledge of the field of biology. Then philosophy comes into the picture and asks the question which Bergson asks in the handout that you'll get today. Please don't forget to take one each of these two handouts. One is a chapter from Bergson's Creative Evolution, and one is a chapter, the last chapter of Spencer's Synthetic Philosophy. Taking the principles of sociology that are the result of observation of civilization and behavior and economics and so on, principles from biology and principles from physics and from astronomy and mythology and so on, then the philosopher asks the question, so does this knowledge give us some advantage with respect to our own survival? Does it affect the way that we interact with others? Is it true? Is the truth, the kind of truth that we get from this kind of understanding, is it the reality that we know? Is this truth that we know about biology the reality of the natural world? Is the reality of the natural world something other than the reality of our constructed knowledge? Or is our constructed knowledge from all of our observation really what the natural world is?
Yes.
She says no, he says yes.
It's limited. It's limited.
All I'm saying is that we're trying to shift from biological understanding of evolution to philosophical understanding of evolution. We're making that shift. We're trying to start to think more philosophically. Well, but the reason, okay, but the reason why, and it came up with Siebe last time, who made quite a nice statement about the fact that we observe progress in nature, and that apparently that progress is the result of some kind of intelligence, and that intelligence is the result, she said, of something she called involution. So she made a big jump in a direction that is based upon a kind of information and a kind of understanding and a kind of theoretical framework that's quite outside of the one that we've been looking at so far. And so what I would like for us to be able to do is think philosophically without jumping to conclusions based upon assumptions that we derive from other fields. Because we can all easily do that. And we can immediately answer all of our questions with a set of assumptions and principles that we have learned in the same way that we have learned about classification of species. We have observed, and we have observed other people's observations, and we have learned categories of understanding, and we can easily apply those categories of understanding to solve all of our questions. So we can say, we can say, okay, we all know that mind is involved in the material universe, otherwise it could not evolve. And so having said that, what do we know about evolution? Or what do we know about anything, having said that?
Very obvious.
Right, and so last time,
our roots
Okay. Last time we derived from our information that we have explored so far, we derived two principles. We derived the principle of unity in diversity based upon our rational comparison of two books, based upon our understanding of the mutuality with regard to food gathering, procreation, protection of environment that we share with all animals. We all do those things, and we know that we're alive, like all animals are alive. So there are certain basic patterns of behavior that we share with animals, which are not rational patterns, which we share with each other. And then on the biochemical level, we share with all species genetic patterns. And so unity is something, unity in diversity is a principle that we, along with all the biologists and philosophers of biology, can derive from this kind of knowledge. And the other principle that sort of peeked out was that the relationship between life and the environment is not mechanistically determined. Mechanistically determined, because there is always the drive from the individual member of the species to enact its patterns in relation to its inner environment and its outer environment. And so everything is not determined from outside. There is something which is passed on through heredity, which continues to determine a certain pattern of behavior performed by each individual as a member of the group, but as an individual in relation to the group and the outer environment.
That can be overridden.
Excuse me?
Cannot that be overridden?
The only point is, the only point that we were trying to make last time was that the pattern of the individual creates the environment to the same extent that the environment creates the pattern of the individual. And somehow this complex is passed on through heredity, and it leads to diversification and speciation, and either ultimately new niches are found or there is extinction. But it's the evolutionary patterns that we've been observing indicate to us that there is a kind of, there's an important principle of individuality and self and self-realization in relation to the environment, which is happening even on the genetic level, because the genes are triggered by certain kinds of environmental influences, and they are triggered to do certain things which they have learned to do over generations and millennia of diversification, but they keep doing those things until there's a damn good reason for them to change, where they have almost no choice. So these two principles, unity and diversity, and self and environment, mutuality between the entity and its circumstances, which tends to almost nullify the idea of strict mechanical determination. There's an intelligence, there's an entity, which is always adapting and always realizing and always creating itself and creating its environment to the same extent that the environment is creating it and influencing it.
You could the animal animals be supramental without knowing it?
I know nothing about that.
That's a question, no?
Okay, see you.
After all, why not? They must evolve and that's also, no?
Okay, please, she wants to ask a question.
I think I've detected a universal pattern that we also can see in the space.
Fantastic, what is it?
Well, if you go back to the Big Bang, you saw that it started with, they think it started with one explosion, lots of particles, and this flew into the space and started to cluster together in groups. And these are still going out into the space and cluster and makes formation that are totally different.
Fantastic.
And if you look at the evolution, you see that it started from one that was many, many small particles. And these particles, again, make groups of particles. And to become to this point that we have monkeys as one group, we have dogs as one, cats as one. We see that these groupings are growing. They can group more and more.
Right. So how would you summarize that universal pattern?
That there is a consciousness behind it.
Okay. Okay. That's trying to explain it. Okay, now this drive which Siv demonstrates to us consistently, this drive to explain things, which is also a drive to reduce everything to the simplest possible formula, is a strong tendency in the human mind. So one of the things that we started to point out last time, and which we will continue to explore, is the extent to which our so-called knowledge is determined by certain patterns of mind, of thinking. Now, one of them is this tendency to find out the reason why, the source. But what was happening just before that was a description of a process. And these two, the final reduction and the process, are characteristic of all of our patterns of thinking. And so that's one of the reasons why in philosophy we look at knowledge as a pattern, a behavior pattern, and then we ask, once we understand something about it, whether the universe itself, the world in which we live, is that, or whether it is a pattern of mind which is creating a picture of that, but which may not in fact be that. Or it may be just close to that. And so in realistic philosophy, the philosophy of realism, there's a belief that this pattern of mind at least reflects that more or less. There's another trend in philosophy which tends to think that it's just itself. The patterns that mind creates are really just patterns of mind and really don't have anything to do with that world in which we are. And so we should notice that when we hold it just for a second, when we observe the classification of species as we just did right now, we have an opportunity to reflect that really doesn't tell us anything about lions and Abyssinian cats and so on. doesn't tell us anything about how wonderful Labrador retrievers are and how their personalities develop and how we share their emotions. Just like what we will find if we observe carefully our own thinking process, we'll find that we have this tendency to reduce patterns of observational change to principles, and then to reify those principles and say, that's it. That is knowledge. That is reality. That's another good question. What do you mean for our understanding of reality, for our behavior, for our wisdom? What does it imply?
What, again, what does it imply?
What do you think it implies?
Well, if... Let me come to philosophical part again.
Please do.
If my faculties of perception and is faculties used, so to say, by a higher consciousness, what I see, what my mind detects, then it has to imply that there is something behind. But if you say that it's only my mind, there can be something else, it's not true that it's at all this, then you imply that there is nothing behind, so to say that it is a constant or a...
And it may be good to ask what we mean by behind. Does it imply that behind there is something connected with in front? Because one of the questions that has come up here a number of times that I'm very interested in is to distinguish between inner and outer with respect to knowledge. Inner and outer with respect to the species type and the environment, the entity and the environment. Upper and lower with respect to abstract consciousness, rational consciousness, and perception, and information, and theory, and existence. You have a comment?
Well, I mean, in a way this is starting at the beginning, because first we have to be able to differentiate between what we call perception and actually what often happens, which is projection. And this we see in work of Darwin, for example. And, I mean, every day when we watch a program about nature on the television, there is an aspect of projection going on, where, and particularly in behavioural observations, where the human tends to project
what?
A heterosexual reading of nature, and it projects this idea that all sexuality is there for reproduction.
May I ask?
And it projects
one question.
Yeah, that's just one
no.
place where.
Yeah, no, I understand. What are they projecting?
They're projecting their own experience onto, and also not even their own experience, but the socially accepted experience of.
Okay. Now, how could you reduce that idea of socially accepted experience to a term? What would you call that term? Yeah, but think of a more polite term for it.
Oh, I'm Scottish, I can't be polite.
How about a philosophical term? Don't tell me Scots can't be philosophers. Okay, I would use the word assumption. People project their assumptions. And their assumptions are based upon their value judgments. Okay, so because of this, philosophers are compelled to ask, what is the relationship between our so-called knowledge and reality?
So-called, yeah, because it brings me back to this, what comes back to my mind all the time,
having, for example, the scientists having seen all this change, for example, and thinking about it, not everything will automatically see the unity. Rather, he will still even go on to exploit nature, even destroy it, and misuse it, the animals in his own lab. So it's necessary to see this to the mind, it doesn't have to differ very much. Whereas another human being who maybe might have never seen even this outer connection, it feels in his heart an identity with another creature. So what is these two things? Because I feel there is, can one bifurcate them? Maybe there has to be something which...
Okay, what are these, what's the relationship between these two different orientations? Is there a commonality, is there a relationship between those two orientations?
I think one has, if you ask for a question behind or in front, so that means there is something else involved which you cannot bifurcate.
Okay, there is in philosophy these days something called deconstructionism. Deconstruction is a process of critically juxtaposing different opposite points of view on the basis of different origins of points of view and considering them in the context of each other without deciding that one or the other is necessarily superior. So if we take, for example, this one of Sri Aurobindo, this is a quotation from Sri Aurobindo. He says, the materialist theory supposes a rigid chain of material necessity. Each previous condition is a coordination of so many manifest forces and conditions. That's what you were describing. Each resulting condition is its manifest result. All mystery, all element of the incalculable disappears. At least the materialist hopes that the incalculable disappears, because that will give him some control. Once more, says Sri Aurobindo, the conclusion is too simple and trenchant. The world is more complex. European thought already tends to posit behind all manifest activity an unmanifest, called, according to intellectual predilection, either the inconscient or the subconscient, which contains more and in a way unseizable to us, knows more and can see more than the surface existence. Out of this unmanifest, the manifest constantly emerges. Then he says, theories of vitalism, idealistic tendencies of thought, which were supposed to have been slain by the march of physical science, now arise, dispute the field, and find their account in every change of scientific generalization, which at all opens the way to their own expansion and reassertion. So let us consider for a minute vitalism, whatever we might think that means, idealistic tendencies of thought, and the idea of the unmanifest, inconscient, or subconscient, and the idea of materialistic cause and effect determining everything. When we put all of these theoretical points of view in relation to each other, we find that idealism and vitalism may be opposed. Materialism and the idea of an unmanifest, unknown influence on things can easily be opposed. The idea of an inconscient and a subconscient or superconscient can easily be opposed. what deconstruction has to do is look at materialism and vitalism and idealism and psychologism, which is the idea of the subconscious, on a plain field. We have to be able to try to understand how each of these points of view formulates the questions that we're asking, addresses the questions that we're asking, if at all it does, and to what extent. And if not to enough, if not adequately, then why not adequately?
And just to tap the ping pong ball back to you, this is another tendency of the human mind, which is to reduce things to dualities.
Yep. So,
but,
right, exactly.
And actually you reduce the discussion.
Okay, now if we take these, if we take these dualities and we deconstruct them, four and five, for example, here's a possible deconstruction. There are mechanical processes in nature, and there is obviously some kind of determinism, for example, in heredity. But it is not absolute, because there is also novelty. The new entity which is created through reproduction is different than anything else, although it does carry certain patterns forward. Certain homeostatic patterns are there. It's the desire for control of nature through accurately predicted occurrences from predetermined causes, the scientific motive, which postulates a principle of mechanical determinism to explain the world. There's a motive for looking for that relatedness. And so Spencer, when you read Spencer in the handout that you'll take tonight, you will see a very elaborate description of how everything has come to be according to the principles identified by Sieve. This idea of clustering and declustering and reclustering and declustering and reclustering, moving from homogeneity to heterogeneity to greater and greater patterns of distinctness to equilibrium, from an original force, whatever it may be. And so he reduces all the phenomena of nature, all the phenomena of society, all of the phenomena of religion, all of the phenomena of physics, to a certain pattern which he describes as the first principle, which is persistence of force, energy in the cosmos. Persistence of force. Second principle, instability of the homogeneous. Third principle, multiplication of effects. Fourth principle, heterogeneity, difference. So, from some initial homogeneity, there results heterogeneity. From heterogeneity, there results equilibrium. And from equilibrium, there results a new heterogeneity. And eventually, from equilibrium, at the end point of change, dissolution. dissolution, extinction of species. And so you'll read this perfect, eloquent description of mechanistic determinism, which allows at the same time everything in time and space to be what it is.
Question, I guess it's a very, very basic question. All of these changes and so on that we're talking about there, are they just simply changes, or are they a motion towards a goal which we aren't aware of yet, but we're starting perhaps to become aware of, or think we'd like to be aware of, or are they just changes and the goal that we're thinking about is just figment of our imagination?
Okay, so the question is all of this process for a goal? And we read this last week in Aristotle. He said all of nature is for a purpose. So in philosophical thinking about nature, from the very beginning, there has been the idea that because apparently wings work for flying and that enhances the lifestyle of the bird, by analogy, we can conclude that the principle of nature, the first principle of nature is that everything that happens, happens for a purpose. And that therefore the essence of something is what it has to become. What it has to become is not in the cell or the atom or the embryo or the growing fetus or the young adult or it's not in any of the stages. The essence of the thing is its totality, its whole being. And everything has a being. Everything is a being. But what the way to know that being is not by looking at all the incremental stages of its movement and its life and so on. It is to know that being as a whole. And that knowledge is separable from that's called the being is what everything else is for. So the matter of the thing is for that, the life of the thing is for that, the intelligence or mind of the thing is for that, and that which everything else is for is the thing. It's the essence, and we know it somehow. We can know it. According to Aristotle, this is knowledge. When we know the thing, and that is an act of mind, and mind is able to separate from all of the temporal becoming the essence, otherwise sometimes called the form. But what he means by form is yet. I mean, we can explore what he means by form or what anybody means by form, but anyway, he means basically essence. And he attributes to that essence cause, ultimate cause. It's there in everything, everything is what it is because of that, and knowledge is knowledge of that. So, in the materialistic view, everything becomes what it is because of these four or five principles of force. When you read that explanation of Spencer, you will see that it's very eloquent. It is perfect. And then you will ask yourself a question, like, what does that have to do with what anything actually becomes? If you apply that principle and that question to an understanding of Darwin, Darwinian evolution, And Darwin has often been referred to as a Spencerian. You will see that the principle of descent of species through variation and natural selection is a similar physicalistic, vitalistic description of a process. Process is the key word, which obviously goes on in nature, but it still doesn't tell us what that has to do with what anything actually becomes. And so this question in language, in linguistics, Chomsky has brought this question forward with respect to language. He says, so language has evolved. And it has similarities with echolocation and stereoscopic sight. It has a certain functional history. And yet, if we look at language and what it does and what it is, how could that possibly be the result of a mechanical process of selection, of variation and selection? Yes, variation and selection are going on there, but language is something like consciousness, which is universal in the human species, which occurred more or less at the same time in human species and has developed more or less the same way, and it serves our survival. But look at how different it is from everything else, how special it is. Language, the ability to communicate, for us to share simultaneously the meaning of these words in the context of all of these ideas, even though we are who we are and we are these conglomerates of organic systems, and we come from these incredible cultures, and we're just ignorant human beings, but yet this language that we have is, it looks like there are no precedents for it, even though there are precedents for it. It's a huge leap away from what bees do with sound and what whales do with sound. It's a huge leap. And so Chomsky will then pause at this point, and he will refer back to a Latin concept called ide innate, innate ideas. That there seems to be in the emergence of structures like sight. Sight doesn't evolve. Seeing evolves. The organs of seeing evolve. But sight remains something quite unique. This ability to see what's there in front of creatures, to interpret light as meaning. You're not just receiving light and processing light in the cells, you are perceiving something. So sight as a mode of perception seems to be something other than the evolution of seeing.
It's not supposed to be the most elaborate form.
Right. So anyway, let me just finish up this deconstruction. So the universe actually is completely indeterminate on the quantum level. we think. It's more constrained on the organized life plane where evolution primarily occurs, more constrained, but there is novelty. And on the mental level, on the mental plane, comparatively very free, but as soon as we engage with life and mind and try to do something mentally, whether it's understand or influence or organize or whatever, we find it's very, very constrained. And how true or not true or effective at any moment is very indeterminate. We only find out as a result of applying mind and seeing where it gets us. And if we look around in the world today, we see that in some ways it gets us into incredible domains of experience, and in other ways it's a total screw-up. So, determinism and indeterminism seem to always actually move in the same sphere. It's not either or. Just like materialism and vitalism and consciousness and inconscient are not either or. They're always factors, complementary factors or necessary correlates. And so it's a mistake, according to deconstruction at least, it's a mistake to try and explain everything deterministically, or explain everything vitalistically, or explain everything idealistically, or explain everything spiritualistically. Because in fact, all of these are levels of the same thing. And so there's a possibility that mind evolves towards not a categorical, theoretical explanation of things, but towards the understanding of being, the direct cognition of each level of that which we are. But in order to do that, we have to somehow negate the rationalistic, categorical thinking and allow ourselves to move into another way of knowing. Knowing the being of things integrally. Last comment.
I should say, it struck me when I was thinking about this survival. It was chosen one time to focus on and see the nature as a survival, in a time when also human beings are struggling for this. Before that, we didn't have the mind even to think survival. Everything was a chance, more or less. We came to survival. And now we have been in the survival, and we enter out of this survival and into seeing the possibilities. And we always focus on the possibilities instead of the problems. And after the possibilities, I suppose, we come to...
Well, in this idea of mutuality versus competition, obviously there's both. But neither one of them really tells us what's going on. We can observe principles of mutuality in nature, and we can observe principles of competition in nature, but neither one of them really explains what's going on in nature. So we have the tendency to put one above the other, to oppose them, depending on our view of society and whatnot, the economic view. But the economic view doesn't explain what's going on. It's an interpretation. It's a way of interpreting. So, for the sake of survival, competition is for the sake of survival. That's just an interpretive point of view. We can say that competition is for the sake of mutual understanding and eventually consciousness. That's another interpretative point of view. But they both keep us stuck in the rational, formulaic way of knowing. The question is, can we know what really is?
Maybe this is a necessary step to see this full round of the rationality's possibility before we can see the whole being as with the elephant.
It's undoubtedly a step. Okay. Please take your handouts today. Read Spencer and Bergson.